I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. Hurricane Sandy created devastation all the way up the Atlantic, from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, to Breezy Point in Staten Island. And in the wake of Sandy, a lot of people are blaming stronger storms on man-made climate change. So if the cause of rising seas and rising temperatures is still being debated, the need for a solution is not. Author Charles Mann says, we have reached a critical point on the largest scale possible. What do we do as a species about climate change? And Charles Mann joins me now. He's a journalist and the author of the books 1491 and 1493. And his latest piece for Orion magazine is State of the Species: Does Success Spell Doom for Homo Sapiens? Charles Mann, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
So I'm going to start with a kind of provocative line that you have from the researcher Lynn Margulis, who you talk about a fair amount in the piece. And you quote her as saying that the fate of every successful species is to wipe itself out. Now, that doesn't feel like success, but tell me why she says that.
Well, Lynn, she just died last year, and so in a way this piece is a memorial to her. She was a very, very prominent biologist at the University of Massachusetts, and her specialty was the microworld. And she had a perspective on what life is that's really quite striking. And her point was that most species, you know, including ours, are generally kept in check by natural selection. Other species eat them, or there's geological or other kinds of biological constraints. But every now and then, a species breaks free of the barriers and just goes wild. And those species tend to wipe themselves out. They drown in their own waste or they exhaust their own resources. So they flourish for a little bit and then collapse. And she was saying human beings, Homo sapiens, look like one of those kind of, quote, successful species.
Hmm. And you talk about this very interesting, at the time, young guy in Russia. And he's trying to come to the U.S., get a Rockefeller Foundation grant. And I think I have the name right here. Is it Georgi Gauss?
Yes,
right?
he's Russian, so Gauza, yeah.
Gauza. And he actually has some similarity in describing certain kinds of populations as what Lynn Margulis does. What does Georgi Gauza explain about the explosion and then often death or disintegration of a species?
What he does, he's one of the great pioneers of microbiology. And he essentially did a series of very simple experiments that many, many college students can now replicate. They're absolutely classic. And he put paramecium, these single-celled creatures, you know, one or two of them, in a petri dish, in a little jar full of nutrients. And what happens is that no constraints from the point of view of the paramecium are visible. And they just reproduce. They go crazy. Then they hit the edge of the petri dish. They run out of everything, and they collapse. And he measured the way that this happens. And there's this particular curve that the population follows, a sort of an odd shape of type of bell-shaped curve. And his argument is this is what happens to all species, you know, big or small, when the constraints seem to go off. They rise up this curve, and then they collapse. And Margulis said, look, you know, the question for us is, are we any different? You know, on a fundamental level, are we any different from little microorganisms that Gauss was measuring in his petri dish? And she argued, probably not.
Now, is your view, what do you think in terms of, could climate change be the catalyst that spurs that ultimate collapse of the species?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, what happens to the species in Gauss's type of experiments is they either eat up everything around them, they exhaust the resources, or they drown in their own wastes. And climate change is a case of drowning in our own wastes. It's the carbon that we emit is a kind of waste, and it is a kind of pollution, and it's, you know, coming back to haunt us. And the point is here that when you look at other species, when you look at the zebra mussels that exploding across Lake Erie, or, you know, any kind of insects that are going crazy, they don't look at the oncoming wall of the petri dish and they say, whoops, we better stop. We better slow down. And that's the natural order. And she said, human beings are species like that. We are now, you know, we're now getting close to the edge of the petri dish. And the normal thing for us to do is to just sail on and smash into it.
Now, you do say, though, that we are different from almost every species because we're innovative in a way that other species don't tend to be. So is it possible that we're going to actually see the wall of the Petri dish before we hit it and are wiped out by it?
Well, that's the kind of gamble that our children are going to make, isn't it? The difference is that human beings have this quality that scientists call behavioral plasticity. And that means we can do things in one way and then suddenly reverse course and do them in another way. If you look at the other kind of complicated societies in the world, like the kind of leaf cutter ants, which have these huge colonies of millions and millions of ants in South America, they're extraordinarily complicated. But none of the ants ever change the rules. They're fundamentally the same in every way that they were thousands of years ago, whereas human beings can profoundly change the rules. And so if we're looking for salvation, if we're looking for a reason to say that we're different than the microorganisms that were in the Petri dish, that would be the reason that we have this kind of behavioral plasticity. And that doesn't mean that we're going to do it, but it means we can.
I want to get to some of the interestingly good signs that you point out in a minute. But first, let's talk about some of the concerns. So we're talking about this population curve. We've got about 7 billion people now. And you point out that, look, by 2050, it's possible that we're going to have something like 10 billion people, which is a huge increase, about a 50% increase in the number of people we've got walking around now. And what are the challenges to the climate and the environment when you put 3 billion more people on the planet?
Actually, it's even worse than that. I mean, one of the great triumphs of, you know, the human race in our lifetimes has been that hundreds of millions of people, most of them in Asia, have been lifted out of destitution. I mean, there's, you know, as a percentage basis, there's fewer people that are desperately poor now than there ever have been in human history. You know, when I graduated from high school in the early 1970s, something like 40% of the human race was malnourished. And now it's something like 8%. I mean, people argue about the exact numbers, but not about the trend. Right. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is not only are we adding 3 billion people, or more or less, to the population, but an increasingly large percentage of them are middle-class people. They're people like us, people who want to have the things that we do. And so we're adding not just mouths, but well-fed mouths, if you understand. And the burden is even heavier.
Right. And the question is sort of how do you add all these people and not ruin the natural systems that we're depending on? How do you not pollute the water? How do you not exhaust all the fossil fuels? How do you not create a situation in which you need more agricultural land than you have? And it doesn't feel like we have the solutions yet, although what do you think?
Well, there's basically two lines of argument about the kinds of solution that we can face. And again, I think that the big decisions for our children's generation will be decided, you know, which of these paths to follow. And one of them is what you can call the technical fix. And that's the idea that science and technology properly applied can help us produce our way out of our fix. And a big example of that would be in agriculture, where we're going to have, you know, most independent studies say that we're going to have to increase the amount of cereals, which are sort of the basic crops, you know, wheat and rice and so forth, produced by about 40%. Now, there's not a lot of land that's not being farmed that's good land. So where's that going to come from? And the technocrats say it's going to come from, you know, substantial genetic modification of the plants. We're going to have to reach into their genomes, tweak their DNA, and make them much more productive. And there's an example of that that I would cite now. There's a major international initiative for the rice genome to change the way photosynthesis works in rice to make rice plants more productive. And that is called the C4 Rice Initiative. And that is the kind of wholesale modification that, you know, the technical fix is. The other way to go about it is to say, no, that's crazy, you know, and to say that's just not going to work. We need to cut back. You know, we need to put on our cardigan sweaters. We need to eat lower on the food chain. And that means we stop eating meat. We stop eating a lot of these products that use up much more than we need. And we eat and we live in a much simpler way. And that those are sort of these radically different alternatives. And in one way or another, you see them. If you read the paper, you see this play of, are we going to do the technical way? Or are we going to do the simpler, smaller way? echoed in countless areas.
Right. And it's not just going forward, because certainly in the past, we have already manipulated plants in ways that help us. We've created synthetic fertilizer. We've already done things, right, that manipulated our environment, even breeding species a certain way, whether it's dogs or pigs or cows. I mean, that helps us live the way we do right now.
Right. And in fact, both of these ways, if you think about it, are a different kind of technology, because if you're going to have everybody living, you know, in smaller, simpler farms and living closer to the land, that kind of perspective, you can't do that by being a lazy person. You have to be intensely knowledgeable about what you're doing. And so both of these represent different ways of applying human technology. The argument I would make is that it's very hard to do both, and that if we spend billions of dollars, you know, kind of making industrial agriculture much more productive, we're not going to be willing to spend billions more, you know, making small farms much more productive in a completely different way.
Is your guess that we have or that we don't have the capacity to do that second kind of manipulation that you were talking about, which is, we'll put on a sweater and eat lower on the food chain?
Well, I think we could, my guess is that we could do it, but it's not a simple solution. It's as much of a wholesale reconfiguration of society as the other one involves as well. None of these are the sort of easy way out. And, that's my opinion. Maybe the future will show me wrong. I think both of these are very, very difficult paths, but they're paths we're going to have to take if we're going to show that, you know, contrary to what Lynn Margulis would suspected, we are a special species.
Now, you do mention some good signs in terms of, we were talking about sort of wholesale behavioral changes. One of them that you note that's already happened since the Second World War is a really marked decline in violence. Why has that happened, and why does it give you hope?
Well, it's really quite striking. This is something that if your readers are anything like my neighbors, a certain number of the people, readers, viewers, excuse me, listeners, are going to be smiting their brow and say, what are you talking about? Look how much war there is. But all the evidence that I know of suggests that there's been this striking decline in violence, particularly since the Second World War, but even in the centuries before that. The archaeological evidence is that somewhere between 25% and 40% of, people living thousands of years ago died by violence. It was an extraordinarily common way to die. And now it's simply not the case in most of the world. And there's a lot of argument about why this is the case. And then there's people who try to put caveats and say, well, there's these subtle signs of violence. And this is true. Probably the leading scholars in this are Steven Pinkert and Joshua Goldstein.
Right.
And Goldstein's book, Winning the War Against War, which I think is really a classic text on this, argues that really what's happened here is the creation of transnational organizations. And we constantly talk about how the UN is ineffective and all these organizations don't do what they're supposed to do. But in fact, they coincide with this dramatic decline in violence. And what's horrifying to contemplate is that even though we open the newspaper and every day see, this ghastly stories about things that are happening in the Congo or the Middle East and Syria, this actually represents progress. It's only happening in a few places, unbelievable though it might seem.
And the amazing thing, too, about looking at wars that occurred in medieval times or earlier is that the kind of violence that existed when people did not have guns was a very brutal, right, in-your-face violence that, as you say, was ubiquitous. I mean, you talk about the 100 years war. I mean, basically, people are like, yeah, we're just at war all the time, so we'll just conveniently call it something like the 30 years war, the 100 years war.
Absolutely. And the conditions were absolutely ghastly. It's been interesting for me. I don't know if you've watched any of that HBO series, the Game of Thrones.
And I haven't.
basically, it's appallingly violent. People are constantly torturing and killing each other. But medieval historians say, yeah, that's the way it was. Your life expectancy was low, and one of the reasons it was low was that you had an excellent chance of being killed in these conflicts that would just rage on for decades.
Right. You also talk about another sort of wholesale change in human behavior. You're talking about sort of plasticity of behavior, and that's the end of slavery and the end of essentially the oppression of women, keeping women mostly out of the workforce, which has only in the last 100 years or so really changed the equation in terms of who can participate actively.
Yeah, our society has changed so much in this regard that it's really hard for people today to cast themselves back and realize what has occurred in the past. Slavery has been an essential part of human society, of almost all, if not all, human societies for as long as we know. The oldest legal codes, like the Code of Hammurabi, are codes of slavery. They tell you what you can do regard to slavery. Slavery changed the way it worked and who was subjugated to it, and lots of details about it. But the essential fact that people could compel others to work for them without compensation was a foundational part of the human enterprise. And then suddenly, at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, it more or less stopped. And slavery certainly exists, but it's uncommon now. And it isn't a foundational human institution across the globe anymore. And this was this extraordinarily dramatic change in society. And it was paired almost simultaneously with the beginning of a realization that all societies that we know of, that archaeologists have ever investigated, were based on the subjugation of women. There are stories about, matriarchal societies, and there are certainly societies in which women were better off than other societies. But as far as we know, in all societies, women were kept in an inferior position. In Europe, in fact, it got worse in Europe as Europe became more technologically sophisticated. In Europe in the 19th century, people of your gender couldn't own property. They couldn't have a bank account. They couldn't vote. They, often couldn't go out without an accompanying male. And they couldn't have a job. I mean, the list of things that they couldn't do, they couldn't go to school, they couldn't go to the university, is just extraordinary. And the freedoms that you, I hoped, take as an accustomed part of life were just simply not possible. And it's really hard to overemphasize what a huge change that was. Something like a quarter, people estimate, of the human race was enslaved. Another half, roughly, was female and, kept suppressed. And suddenly, in our time, all these people have been freed to one extent or another, and all these talents are allowed to, participate in the human enterprise. It's an incredible change. And to me, speaking personally, the idea that after, licking this, that we would fail to deal with global warming just seems, I don't know, it's really tough to contemplate.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH, and I'm speaking with Charles Mann, author of 1491 and 1493. And his latest piece for Orion magazine is State of the Species: Does Success Spell Doom for Homo Sapiens? And Charles Mann, I want to bring you back to that question of whether we are different enough from other species to see to see our own end and do something about it. So I wonder if you look at our history and you look back at the very beginnings of human history, is there something about humans in our evolution that you think might set us apart from, the ants or the paramecium that they just don't see the end coming?
Well, there's really two kind of opposing tendencies. One is that, as Lynn Margulis, the scientist we've been talking about, constantly would reiterate, we are a species like any other. That's the central premise, a central premise of biology, that, on a fundamental level, all of us are creatures of DNA. All of us, have the same imperatives. All of us, are operating under the same rules of evolution. That's a sort of basic understanding of modern biology. And so it's foolish from this perspective to say that we would see the edge of the petri dish and, turn course. Because why would we? I mean, we're living creatures. The other perspective, I think, is the one from the social sciences, which says, well, look, people are just really different than other species. We are an exception. And the irony here, as Lynn liked to point out, is that the idea that we would conserve the natural world is profoundly unnatural. I mean, no fire ant colony that's eating up every single species of invertebrate in its environment worries about conserving the resources.
Right. They don't care.
Right.
They're just
they don't care.
That's hungry.
Not what they're there. They're hungry. They eat. people do this, and that's a profoundly weird thing. And what we're being asked to do is, from point of view of biologists, which is, you know, what we're being asked to do is to step back and think about what we're doing, is profoundly odd from a biological point of view. But it may be, we may be able to do it. We may be just weird enough.
Yeah, and you point out this Japanese tendency to stop before you're full, which is maybe counterintuitive for almost every species, but humans seem to be able to do it.
Right. It's called it's an expression in Japanese, harahachibu. It comes from Okinawa, and the idea is you don't stuff yourself. You stop a little bit beforehand. And maybe we're going to have to do that on a larger scale.
We've been speaking with Charles Mann. He is the author of two books, 1491 and 1493. And his most recent piece in Orion magazine, which we've been talking about, is State of the Species, Does Success Spell Doom for Homo Sapiens? You can find links to all of those at our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. Charles Mann, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And Callie Crossley is back.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We'll be back tomorrow, noon to 2. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great afternoon.